You are listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, and our collective human existence. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist with Healthful Living, and I'm a Healthful Living advocate. You can learn more about me and the show at healthfulliving.org and realitysandwichradio.com. I'm on today with my co-host, Julie Matthews.
I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living as well.
And Julie's also going to be our guest for today's show. Today we're going to be speaking more on a topic we've covered a bit in the past, but a little more in depth and kind of wider and deeper as well. Julie last week was speaking at the Defeat Autism Now conference back in Washington, D.C., and folks can learn more about autism and about the Defeat Autism Now organization at danconference.com. And they are an offshoot of the Autism Research Institute. And she presented there on nutrition foundations for autism. As we presented on a number of previous shows, we've done interviews with various practitioners that are treating autism and various different modalities. And we've spoken quite a bit about it. And today I want to speak with Julie a bit about the DAN organization. And they are unique in autism treatment in that they're actually treating the physical symptoms of these children. And there are a tremendous number of doctors and researchers that are out actually working with the physical, common physical symptoms in these children and helping to intervene with them and help them improve their overall symptomology. And what Julie's work does is she works alongside helping parents and doctors to help families apply the nutritional intervention component of helping these kids through dietary means. So I'm going to ask Julie just to begin from there, because some folks may be listening and hearing, you know, dietary intervention or nutritional intervention for autism, and even it goes broader for autism and ADD and other childhood disorders. So I'm going to just have Julie begin with a little bit of an overview of nutritional intervention. Why is nutrition so important for these kids?
Nutrition can have a huge impact on anybody. We see people all the time that have a health challenge or health crisis, and what's one of the first things they do is hopefully address their diet. And the same thing applies for children and children on the autistic spectrum. So going back, when I talk about autistic spectrum, I'm including everything from, like you mentioned, ADHD to autism, Asperger's, and a variety of other common child neurological imbalances. And so these foods make a huge difference for several reasons. Firstly is because some of these foods are actually toxic to kids. And it's not that the food is inherently toxic. It's that if you can't process or break down certain components, then they can build up toxic byproducts, or the additives in them are toxic. So there's several things on that front, from food sensitivities and intolerances that create inflammation. They inflame the gut. They decrease the ability to absorb nutrients. You can imagine now, if you have toxins, you have, let's say, both foods that are creating inflammation as well as chemical additives that are wreaking havoc on the liver and the system. Combine that with nutrient deficiencies, because the digestive tract now is not going to be absorbing those nutrients very well, and you have a really big impact that nutrition plays, both positively and negatively, depending on what the nutrition of the individual is.
So if I step back a quick second, I hear you speaking that a lot of these kids are having challenges with the foods that they're routinely consuming.
Right.
And that they can't process them properly. They're having adverse reactions to some of the ingredients, artificial ingredients. Their systems can't tolerate them. What is some of the common understanding of, you know, why that is?
Well, let me actually step back for a minute and say what are these symptoms that people are getting, and then it might make more sense to explain what they are. It can affect everything from neurotransmitters, things like attention, aggression, to energy, hyperactivity, fatigue, digestive disturbances, inflammation, gut problems, all of those variety of different systems that can be affected, from the inflammatory system to the neurological, digestive, as well as the immune system and the inflammatory response. And so these can interfere in a variety of ways. One is by creating a damage to the gut, and that can be done by these inflammatory foods, things like gluten, which is in wheat and some of the other grains, and dairy, the protein in dairy called casein. Those are a couple of them. Soy is often a problem. Corn is a problem. Sometimes eggs are a problem. And it could be a classic allergy, but more often for these kids, it's a more of a delayed food sensitivity, and it creates more of these chronic digestive inflammatory responses.
So there's a whole host of physical maladies going on with these children beyond the observable psychological or social components that people are so routinely familiar with when they think of autistic children.
Right.
They think of behavioral delay, challenges communicating, social inhibitions, these kind of things, which are manifestations of their overall condition.
Correct.
And this particular organization is looking at, what's going on overall in the body holistically, mm-hmm. mind and body, and how can they intervene to help the overall functioning of these kids.
Yes. So Dan does something what they call biomedical. I might call it, explain it more in terms of balancing the biochemistry of the individual person. And so the biochemical or biomedical approach has to do with balancing the biochemistry that is, for whatever reason, out of balance. It often has to do with toxins, but there could be a variety of different environmental assaults that happen to these kids that create these imbalances that they end up with.
Well, when you speak of environmental assaults, I mean, certainly we're living in a world today that's significantly more environmentally toxic than it was just even 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And as many have noted, a lot of press lately about the increased rates of autism. Now, I think 1 in 166. What's your take on where those numbers are coming? I know many people are saying that it's better diagnostic techniques, so more people are being included in that diagnosis. Others are pointing to other triggers that could be increasing these numbers.
Right. The Mind Institute, which is at UC Davis, talks about that it can't be just better diagnostic techniques, because where would all the 30-year-old autistic people that had autism that weren't found at the time, where are they? Or they also say that genetics don't create epidemics. So if you're going to have an epidemic of something, it usually is because of some assault that happens somewhere. Genetics alone do not create epidemics, or else it would already be existing in our population, and it did not exist to the point it is today. So people at the Mind Institute say that it cannot be explained by better diagnostic techniques alone.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of I guess I just want to speak a little bit to people out there that may know somebody with a child with autism, or is recently dealing with a diagnosis, and they're just beginning to kind of understand, what can they do, right? Mm-hmm. What are their options? And there's a host of different options, and it really depends on the initial clinician that the parents encounter as to what direction they're pointed in. And it is still fairly mainstream practice today to see autism as strictly a psychological disorder,
mm-hmm.
and hence to pursue medical treatments along the lines of certain pharmaceuticals and of course, behavioral therapy,
mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is... I believe the most effective as far as, dealing with the circumstance.
Yeah, sure. And there's a time and a place for everything. So mm-hmm. there's a time for pharmaceuticals. There's always different learning therapies go hand in hand with other therapies that people might do. One of the approaches with Dan is to get the attention as going as good as possible, get the brain firing as well as we can, get all of the systems and the learning systems on a biochemical level going so that when you employ different teaching strategies, they will be more effective, which is what a lot of people have found out. The ARI has research, has, what do I want to say, polled or sent out questionnaires to thousands and thousands of parents, and they have come up with what they find the most effective interactions to be, whether it's a drug, a nutritional supplement, a diet, all sorts of things, and the parents rate them. And while this isn't a scientific double-blind study, it is some pretty good parent experience with now thousands and thousands of parents responding to what modifications seem to offer some of the best support. And interestingly, some of the diets and some of the nutrients have a 60-70% positive effect with very small negative effect, maybe a couple percent. So it seems that a lot of parents are finding that while sometimes medications and things are absolutely necessary, that other people find that sometimes some simple food and nutrition approaches can provide a huge benefit, sometimes even profound benefit, with often very little downside.
Right. I'd like to speak a little bit about that, because I was at the conference as well. I've heard story and story over and over again from parents who didn't know earlier about dietary intervention and perhaps even came across just some of the significant diet books out there. I know there's a diet book on a gluten and casein-free diet, eliminating both gluten and casein from the diet, just beginning with that particular component. And they had some of them, startling, sudden shift in their child's behavior or some expanded cognition or something changed, like, pretty rapidly. And just to hear those people's stories was very surprising, that they just said, oh, my God, I can actually, affect this myself by what I'm feeding my child. So I'd like you to speak just a little bit about the significance of, just any dietary intervention to help these kids.
Well, you're talking specifically right now about gluten and casein. Would you like me to speak specifically?
Well, let's talk about that. Why are those two particular things potentially implicated in the child's behavior?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of inflammation that's often created from these foods. There's often a big immune system response, and the immune system creates inflammation. And with that, the side that handles viruses and other microorganisms is often weakened. So you have a over-inflammatory allergy side and an under-functioning side that fights off viruses and things. And so you end up with these foods kind of perpetuating in the gut. Why do we keep talking about food in the gut? Because 70% of the immune system is in the gut and 90% of serotonin is in the gut. So both the neurological system and the immune system have a really big effect or set of things in common with the gut. So everything that goes into the gut affects these other two systems as well. So when you have these foods that the body can't tolerate, number one, it creates inflammation, which creates more microorganisms, that things like bad bacteria and other things that create a host of brain toxins that are given off. They are also the natural digestive system and absorption of these nutrients is lowered when the digestive system is under a lot of inflammation. You also have a whole immune system response that's created, and with that you tend to have endorphins and that are produced, and endorphins can create a whole host of, as you can imagine, changes in the neurochemistry or the chemistry of the brain, creating lots of cravings for the food as well as irritability and lethargy and aggression and all sorts of things. And you end up with also certain kids produce opiates. So specifically gluten and casein are particularly problematic because they often create opiates out of these two compounds. So you can imagine if you were on morphine all day long. You would be probably fairly foggy and fuzzy headed and would be hard to concentrate. You might be also frustrated or irritated. So it's like these poor kids are making or imbalancing their brain chemistry based on simply some of the foods that they're eating in the diet every day.
And what kind of behaviors are they exhibiting if they're having a reaction, for example, to gluten or casein?
So it might be an emotional reaction. It might be aggression, irritability, depression. It might be digestive. So they might have diarrhea, constipation, pain, all of those types of things that are created. There might be attention challenges or some challenge in learning. What else? There could be pain. There could be headaches. There could be digestive pain. A whole variety of...
Because I think we all have felt a time where something we ate didn't agree with us in some way, and it just really felt, you know, really bad. We couldn't think straight. We were feeling very uncomfortable. So I can imagine, you know, a young child who doesn't really have, you know, necessarily the ability to communicate what's going on,
right?
Having these types of reactions to certain components of some of the foods that they're taking in. Why are they sensitive to it? Why? I mean, it's not every child that is having reactions per se to these to these things. What's going on with some of these kids? And I guess now, you know, with these increasing numbers, you know, many of them having reactions to these foods.
Well, there appears to be some genetic component because they tend to run in families. However, genetics alone don't seem to explain it, like I mentioned earlier. If so, we would have had all of these people with these same disorders 10, 20 years ago or having it run in families then. So, you know, it's hard to know exactly. There seem to be several different genetic components, things such as the methylation process not working, the biochemical sulfation system not working very well, which would affect detoxification and digestion and a variety of other systems. There seems to be some kids with certain Mary Megson did some work on G-alpha protein defects. So there's this, that you get this population of people that is genetically susceptible or weak in this particular way, and then you get a variety of things. It's not just foods. Foods are sometimes the direct cause, but more often a result of some other problem that has made them unable to digest a food that you should be able to digest or to be able to detox a toxin that normally you should be able to. But for this group of people, that often doesn't happen. And often those biochemical systems are affected based on some sort of toxins that knock out certain pathways or overload certain pathways.
Well, I guess this gets to some of the reality sandwich component in that we are living in a significantly toxic world. And those toxins are beginning to affect us and our children and are showing up all over the place with respect to the, you know, significantly increased numbers of childhood disorders.
There was a study done by the Environmental Working Group, trying to remember the name of it. I don't remember, but it was testing the placenta, I believe, for toxins that were found in the placenta, and they found, and I forget the quote now, but it was like 217 chemicals found, and of them, a huge number of them were both neurotoxic and carcinogenic.
Nice.
So you can just imagine and there are tens of thousands of these chemicals in our environment. And I think they tested 200 and something, and like 217 came back showing in the placenta. So there are a huge exposure, and they have some pretty serious impacts on being toxic directly to the brain, but they're also toxic to some of these biochemical processes that would help process them out and make them less toxic, but they don't even have those systems working to naturally get rid of these chemicals. So they have the double whammy.
Right. So we're hitting ourselves with so many more, pathogens and attacks and chemicals and all kinds of stuff, yet the human body isn't able to evolve rapidly enough to increase its ability to deal with them, to filter them, especially at a very, very young age. So I'm not a doctor, I'm not a physicist, I'm not a biochemist, but I can begin to put pieces together and say, well, eventually there's going to be spillover. I mean, you can only handle so much. And right. It seems, from what I'm hearing by listening to doctors and listening to clinicians and listening to reports and reading, that that something's going on, mm-hmm. that there's more childhood disorders showing up, and that we absolutely need to be expanding our minds as to what's affecting it and how we can help these kids. And a huge component of helping them is restricting what they're being exposed to by way of the ingestion of foods,
mm-hmm.
for one.
Exactly. Just that's take some of the burden off the system,
right.
as well as adding nutritious foods into the diet. Because let's face it, the worst population of the population that's fed the worst food are kids.
Mm.
We feed them kids' foods. We feed them cereals and chocolate chip pancakes, and if that weren't bad enough, neon-colored cereals and, quote, fruit chews that have barely any fruit at all but tons of artificial colors and flavors. And the kids are bombarded with not only not nutritious food but actually toxic food. So just simply switching to nutritious food alone, mm-hmm. would make a huge difference. And it's something that usually parents need to kind of go out of their way to do, because they're not just readily available in different packaged products. You often have to make them yourself.
So have you heard personal stories of people that have made some quick shifts and had some quick awakenings and then some responses for their kids?
Sure, absolutely. Sometimes things like gluten and casein, sometimes you see attention improve, so that therapists will say, I don't know what you've been doing, but keep doing it, because their child was catching on or learning better or figuring out new things, able to pay attention, those kinds of pieces. Sometimes learning or language specifically is improved. I had one child with zero words that ended up with about 200 words in the course of a few months after taking out a few of these foods like gluten and casein. So sometimes it's little subtle, step by step. You notice a little bit of an improvement here, a little bit of less tantrums, few less stomach complaints. Little by little, things seem to get better. And then sometimes you see fairly dramatic improvement in a short period of time.
Hmm. I'm sure people are listening and just really fascinated, because I have spoken to a number of parents who went through this when they first were hearing about this, that these are interventions that they can be doing themselves and that they weren't told before. Nobody mm-hmm. ever told them that they can be modifying their diet or supplementing or really treating the whole child, that they didn't know that before.
Yeah, it's something that if you go in mainstream circles, you won't hear a lot about it. But if you go online and you Google gluten-free, casein-free autism, you will find dozens and dozens of books and parent stories and websites and all sorts of information dedicated to it. And so while some people will say we don't have any research or whatever else, there's actually quite a bit of research showing the opiate component from these foods, or there's a lot of parents that could tell you that this diet has significantly helped them. So it's something that appears to have little to no downside and lots of positive benefit for lots of parents.
Right. And certainly the more options parents have, the greater as far as taking control of doing their best for their own child. Now, of course, you're not a doctor, so you don't personally treat people. You don't have a clinic per se, and you're not able to diagnose anything. But your particular expertise has been in researching the biochemistry and understanding how this nutritional component is affecting these kids.
Yeah, you can see when you, if you like if you have an adult with migraines and you take out MSG or you take out artificial colors, you can see those headaches go away. Mm. Same thing with these kids. You take out a food and digestion improves. You add in a nutrient and sleep improves. You know, these, you can see some of these dietary interventions really make a positive impact according to what the parents are saying about their child and their progress.
Right, right. You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco. We're doing today's show with our co-host, Julie Matthews, who is a certified nutrition consultant, who was speaking last week on Nutrition Foundations for Autistic Spectrum Disorders at the Defeat Autism Now conference back in Washington, D.C. And I just want to jump in here, Julie, a little bit now. What was your particular talk around, and what were you bringing forth to share with parents and fellow clinicians and doctors from around the world that were convening at this conference?
Well, I talked about nutritional foundations for autistic spectrum disorders. So I talked about some basics on nutrition, fats, carbs, protein, why they were important, good sources to get for them, just, you know, some basic nutrition information. And then I went into a lot of the diet options that are out there. In autism, gluten and casein free is one of the most common and one of the most impactful. But there are 6 to 9 autism diets out there, and different ones work well for different people or in different combinations depending on the person and their circumstance. So I went through a bunch of the different diets and which ones were beneficial. Those include things like, in addition to the gluten and casein-free diet, the specific carbohydrate diet or the fine gold diet, the low oxalate diet, the body ecology diet, yeast diets. There's many, many different options out there for people. And so just trying to help them figure out where to start and where to go and how to evolve one of those diets over time. And then just going into some of the what I would call nutrient boosters, which are ways to now boost the nutritional content of these foods. Since these kids don't absorb the nutrients very well, we want to really maximize every nutrient and every food that we can. And most kids aren't necessarily the models for, you know, perfect nutrition. And of course, kids on the autistic spectrum tend to be even more picky and more limited. And so how can we get or sneak some of these nutrients in for your standard kid, child, or child that is having even more food challenges?
I'd imagine those nutrition boosters would be good for any children.
They're great for anybody. And so my talk was really on how to evolve the diet for the whole family. How, if you employ these ideas for your child on the spectrum, of course it will have impact in those areas. But also, what about the sibling with asthma or the sibling with ADHD or the dad with migraines or the mom with depression or all of those things? So looking at all of these good nutrition foundations really apply to all people.
Well, what I found really fascinating was just sort of the bottom line understanding of the direct connection between what we eat and what's going on in our bodies, and how even as we progress forward in time now, there's still, you know, a significant energy, I don't know how to explain it, in the world that's trying to suppress that basic connection. And whenever people allow themselves to wake up to the reality of that connection, they can make their own little subtle shifts. You know, it doesn't mean they have to radically alter their world, but just by their own choosing, you know, make a modification here, leave this out, leave that out, and then something happens, like their migraines stop, and they go, wow, I didn't realize that, you know, just that one thing with that food coloring in it, for example, or that one product that I didn't know had MSG in it but did have MSG in it was triggering somehow in me, you know, those migraines.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Most people, they just don't know. They don't – I don't know if there's – We could argue whether there's an active suppression of the information, but in reality, what's most likely happening is that people just don't know. People aren't informed. They don't they don't get the information they need for whatever reason, and they just don't realize that food has that big of an impact. And if they've never tried to change their diet before, they're not aware that diet can have an impact on their health situation.
Right, right, until they make a shift in some way. Because there's, I can definitely understand there's an aversion to doing it, because we don't like to acknowledge that we're being, you know, manipulated or sold, or, you know, having not necessarily completely true information thrown at us by the companies that are selling us stuff.
Right.
Right. Or that, you know, the FDA allows certain things to be sold that may not be the best for us. And, you know, it's pretty easy to complain about that and or just say, oh, if it wasn't okay, it wouldn't be on the shelf. You know, even though we pretty much know that there are some things that are pretty offensive.
Mm-hmm.
But until we make our own choice to either select something instead of a particular thing,
mm-hmm.
right, to choose to have, you know, a bunch of baby carrots instead of that can of Pringles, for example, you know, whatever it may be for you, until we at least make one little choice like that, do we not allow ourselves the personal feedback of doing something for ourselves? And there's nothing more powerful than proactively doing something intentionally for our own health, be it, you know, bringing something new in or intentionally avoiding something that we're learning might be a little bit problematic.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
It goes a long way.
Absolutely. So that was pretty much the basis of my presentation, was what can parents take home tomorrow and implement in their life that would make a difference for themselves, their child on the spectrum, and the rest of the children in their family.
What are a couple of areas around just general diet, general food, general nutrition that would be really helpful for any parents of any children to just to take a little more insight into? Because I know, you know, children are clearly, you know, they're in developmental stages. They have a lot more nutritional needs likely than any other stage in their, you know, human lifespan. And what are some things that you're seeing as a nutrition consultant really are just, you know, really missing out there?
Well, I would say that one of the really basic things is fat. Mm. We're always taught that fat is bad, that it's somehow an advantage and positively looked upon if we can starve ourselves of fat, if we can do low-fat everything. The lower the fat, the better it is. And that, I would say, is probably the biggest myth, and actually pretty harmful to young kids, would be to limit the fat. And I would say that that's probably the first thing is that. And then secondly, I would say just looking at the quality. We never really look at quality. We just look at fats, carbs, protein, calories, those kind of macronutrients. We don't look at, okay, well, is this animal fat a good animal fat or is it a bad one? How was it created? How was it processed? How was it grown? All of those components we never really look at. So when we look at fats, there are some fats that are terrible. Trans fats, hydrogenated oils, all of those things are very unhealthy. They cause heart disease. They contribute to diabetes. They are bad and difficult for kids on the spectrum. They imbalance the good fats. They're really harmful for everybody. And if you're just counting calories and you're just counting fat grams, you're not going to notice the difference, and you're not going to be aware that quality plays a role. So looking at getting good sources, natural, whole, unrefined, unprocessed fats, you know, nuts and seeds and good animal fats raised from pastured animals, and all sorts of avoiding all of the big vats of oil that come in the big plastic jugs that you get at the grocery store of the canola oil and those things, avoiding those and going with some of the more unprocessed things. So that would be, I guess, two of them: eating more fats and eating good quality foods.
Good fats. I know coconut oil is one of your favorites.
Yes, I love coconut oil. It's not only is it delicious, but if you get a good, again, unrefined coconut oil, it's going to be high in lauric acid, which is found in breast milk and has great antiviral, antifungal properties. It's a very quick source of energy, so it's not stored as fat. It's burned quickly for energy. It's got caprylic acid, which kills yeast overgrowth. It's definitely one of my favorites.
So a quick aside on the coconut oil thing, because I know that there's probably about 87 listeners right now going, I've heard that coconut oil is really bad for you because there were some studies done back in the whenever about popcorn and coconut oil, and it's really, really bad. So how can you be talking about how great it is?
Well, there's a couple things. One is that our understanding has changed. So before we lumped everything together, trans fats and saturated fats were all lumped together into one category, and trans fats are unhealthy, but saturated fats are healthy. And you can look at population studies of Pacific Islanders or cultures that use a lot of coconut fat, and you'll see that their rates of heart disease and all those sorts of things are very low. We can look at what I believe one of the main things was that there were some studies done in the 70s of coconut oil using hydrogenated coconut oil, and we already know that hydrogenated oils are bad. And so, but you don't need to hydrogenate coconut oil because it's already saturated. So looking at, again, the quality of the study of the foods that were used in the study will tell us if the food is actually a good food or a harmful food. So a lot of the information that we have now is showing that these components, they can't really be isolated. We have to look at the human being as a whole and see how these affect the entire system.
Hmm. So let's just bring this back for a minute to autism and to diet for autism. We were speaking a bit about that earlier in the show. And we have some... at the conference, after you spoke, there were a lot of questions and answers that were asked of you, and I'm sure that likely many parents will log on to the show and listen to some more of your overall insight with regard to nutrition. But I wanted to just ask you firstly, before you begin some of those specific questions, what percentage of kids out there, generally speaking, that have never tried to, look at dietary intervention, what percentage of them get some sort of get some sort of a gain back of it, or some sort of improvement?
Well, I don't think I can answer the question myself, but if you go to Dan or Autism One and you look at that, it's called Publication 34, I think is the name of it, and it goes into all how parents rate these different options. And sometimes diet, gluten and casein free diet, for example, has a 65% benefit. So 65% of the people showed some benefit from the diet. There were maybe, of the remaining 35%, only probably a few percent that actually, quote, got worse using the diet. There's other diets. I would say many of the diets, the fine gold diet, I think rated somewhere in the 50% or more. So, if you were to look at, often I'll have doctors say, if I had a drug that could help 65% of the people and improve them with very low side effects, that would be a huge success for them. So these diets are often some of the first things that doctors suggest employing because they have such a positive benefit.
Right. And before you go into some of the questions, I just want to just elucidate a little bit for listeners about this organization and what's going on out there with respect to their addressing autism. There's a whole host of doctors and researchers and various clinicians working together with parents of children to help figure out what's going on with these kids and how they can best be helped through multiple modes of intervention. And it's just a real – when I hear the doctors speak and I hear the parents speak, and it's like, this is a major epidemic, and it's a terrible thing that's happening to our children in our world, and yet here are these people out here doing their best to work on it, to figure it out. Here's doctors listening to parents, taking in the information, having that guide their directive research, more information coming in. There's a big circular loop going on amongst all the different people that are involved in this. Whereas, unfortunately, people find that in the standard, not knocking mainstream, but just speaking about something that we're noticing there, a very top-down only dictatorial kind of treatment modality. Doctors tell you, here's what's going on, and they don't know much, beyond what they have learned. They don't necessarily listen to what the parents have to say. This is a completely different, you know, very open organization of people out there, you know, listening to one another and figuring this out. And the greatest information comes from the people on the front lines of the parents. They know what works, what doesn't work, and they can feed that back in to help themselves and others as best they can work towards towards treatments and towards helping these kids as best as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just phenomenal to listen to the parents and to hear their depth of research and then to read some of their very specific questions that they have about nutrition or biochemistry as they themselves are working so hard to help their kids and to help others.
Yeah. So I wanted to take a few minutes to go through some of the questions because we didn't get to all of them there. There were four speakers, all the afternoon speakers, myself and three others were up there answering questions from an audience of 500 people. So you can imagine there were far more questions than we had time to address. So I thought I would take a little bit of time to answer some of those questions for people. The first one is talk about arsenic as a deterrent in rodents in chicken feed. Is it in the chicken and eggs we eat? So the answer to that is if you eat non-organic or non-pastured chickens and you're getting the standard feed, they do put arsenic in it to prevent the rats from eating it. And so as strange as that sounds, then the chickens eat it and the chickens have arsenic and we eat the chicken and now the chicken's got arsenic. So, yeah, you want to be careful and you want to get the best quality food that you can find. And the second half of the question is, we don't eat beef. Is lamb a good substitute? And I would say yes, definitely. There's some lamb tends to be a low allergenic food. It's got lots of good fats in it. And if it's raised in a grass-fed or pastured manner, it's actually quite healthy and is a good substitute for people that either can't do beef or don't eat beef. Okay, let's see here.
So you really have to be thinking about what's going on in, you know, in the food that you eat. I mean, it wasn't until the past few years that we would really begin to think about, you know, what are they feeding these animals that are affecting us?
Right, right. And a lot of animals like cows, they don't eat grain. Mm. So if you can imagine eating a diet that you normally would never have eaten in the wild. It's not how your digestive system's set up. It's not particularly healthy for you. All right, let's get to another one here. I've tried the gluten and casein-free diet but saw no change. Is this common? Do I need to try a more restrictive diet? Well, I would say a couple things. Firstly, the GFCF, by the way, is the gluten-free, casein-free diet. And it's a bit of a tricky diet. You have to follow it pretty strictly. So if there's a lot of times I'll hear, well, I gave up milk. You know, my child gave up milk and wheat and it didn't go away. You need to be very strict. You need to give up all gluten grains, which includes rye, barley, spelt, kamut, commercial oats, as well as wheat, and all dairy products, including butter and small amounts of milk or anything like that, or little bits of cheese. So if all of that is not out of the diet, then you won't see the positive benefit. So I would say, firstly, was the trial long enough? I would say a minimum of 3 months, if not 6 months. And was it a full, complete dietary trial? If that's the case and the person was doing that, they may need to do a little bit more of a restrictive diet. Often soy and corn are problems, and when people take out dairy, they often substitute soy and soy milk and all of those. And when they take out wheat, they often add more rice and corn. And while rice is typically good, corn is often problematic. So sometimes you end up with substituting one problem for another one, and you may not see the benefit. So sometimes you do need to add a little bit more restriction to the diet from there. And let's see, someone was asking what some of the main sources of oxalates in the diet are, because the low oxalate diet removes these high oxalate foods. Oxalates are the things that create, most commonly known for creating kidney stones, those sharp little crystals that create a lot of pain and inflammation. They are mostly found in things like nuts and grains and beans, a lot of those, what are traditionally seeds in nature, have a lot of oxalates on the outside. Also, even a lot of leafy green vegetables, certain fruits like berries. So there's a wide range of foods among all different categories that contain oxalates. So avoiding them is helpful. And then the second question was, can I talk about some of the foods that contain phenols? So phenols is another diet, and that's usually implemented with the Feingold diet. And we'll have Jane Hersey on. She's going to be talking specifically about this diet for autism at some point in the future. But those foods are natural and artificially occurring. These phenols are just basically a benzene ring with a hydroxyl group on them, and they are both in artificially created things like petroleum. So any petroleum-based additives, all artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives, most people don't realize come from a base of a petroleum molecule. And so those are particularly difficult. So that's one of the reasons we take those out. And then also naturally occurring phenols in the form of salicylates, and those are things like apples and grapes and raisins and chocolate and honey and zucchini. So a variety of fruits and vegetables. And people can find out more on that one at feingold.org or adddiet.org.
It's sounding pretty complex, and what I'm hoping that anyone who's listening who either has a child, knows somebody with a child, looks after children, teaches them, has seen behavioral stuff in them, that they're beginning to open their mind up to all kinds of potential connections between certain things in their diet, certain ingredients that could somehow be connected to something that's manifesting in them behaviorally. I mean, there's all kinds of different things that are happening in our world today, and it's not a matter of, eating nothing but water, but it's a matter of firstly understanding that there's a lot of stuff going on, and that means that we can be involved in modifying it and helping to improve their health.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm going to take one last question.
Sure.
Before we end. My son is a vegetarian and is on a gluten and casein-free diet. What alternative is there to soy milk and soy cheese? So from their situation, they are limited to a vegetarian diet, but I had mentioned in the talk that I didn't think that soy was a good substitute for dairy or as a vegetarian protein source because of a variety of things. It creates inflammation to the gut. It creates a lot of it can inhibit thyroid function. It can also imbalance hormones, and both for boys and girls, that's not a good thing. And so there are definitely some alternatives if people are taking out casein or dairy and they want to also avoid soy. What can they do? Well, they can do all sorts of other types of milks. There's nut milks, almond milk, hazelnut milk. There's coconut milk. You can also get potato milk. There's rice milk. So there's many good milk substitutes. The cheese one is kind of a challenge. There, I have to say, not really many great cheese substitutes. Even the rice cheese and almond cheese, they make it with caseinate, which is a casein derivative. And so the cheese piece is a tough one, but the milk part actually is pretty easy to find quite a few substitutes for.
So in our final few moments, so much of what you're speaking about, and we're speaking specifically to autism today, but also ASDs, which is a broader spectrum beyond simply autism. And a lot of this applies, a lot of these notions of understanding that there's connections between the foods that we eat and artificial ingredients and stimulants and all these different things and behavior of not just autistic children but also ADD and ADHD. So much of this understanding applies to a broader array of children.
Right.
And that people that are listening can take that in and realize that there's a lot more going on that they can actually affect, they can be in control of.
Mm-hmm.
And that, at least my message in to listeners and to the world is that, we're learning this, we're taking this information in, and it's really time for us to be directing our energy into what we can do, what we can learn, and how we can connect with others who've been learning the same thing
mm-hmm.
to empower ourselves. And while there's always a time to be angry and yell at the scream for the companies for selling us mm-hmm. the junky foods or for manipulating us into buying the junky foods, they're not going to change. They're not going to stop doing it. And the system isn't going to change to suddenly help all of us. that we need to be putting our resources into, you know, learning and figuring it out amongst ourselves. And that's the most empowering thing. And when I speak to parents that are getting information, that are empowering themselves, that are making changes, that are helping their kids, that's really where it's at. And it's a really beautiful thing to see. And in the face of their difficulties, you know, they're trudging ahead and doing what they can. And no matter who you are out there, no matter what you're dealing with, that's all you can really ask of yourself, is to give it your best shot and just honestly be moving in that direction as best as you can.
Absolutely. And there, while hopefully we're avoiding processed foods as much as we can, the good news is that I don't know if it's good news, but there are a lot of people that are having similar intolerances to some of these foods. So the good news is that there are companies, more and more companies, making rice milk products and nut milk products and gluten-free products and all sorts of things.
Right.
So while someone is transitioning, they don't need to change their lifestyle overnight and employ a whole new strategy. They can little by little start to make some changes and choose healthy options and get some support on the way.
There's definitely options out there, and folks can read a bit more about that and your work and more about your book also at nourishinghope.com, Julie's new blog site we just launched last week.
And there'll be some information from some of those Q&A questions and some others. There must be at least 20 questions here, and we maybe got to 10 of them at the talk and another several here, so there's more that will be up on the website shortly.
Excellent. Thanks for chatting with us today, Julie.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be able to share what I learned.
So you can listen to this show and hear it again, or turn it on to anybody else that you know who has a child who looks after them. The show will be up for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. Probably be up in the next day or so. We'll be back next Thursday at noon. Our guest will be Mark Kimmel, and we'll be speaking about two paradigms that are really unfolding in our world today and helping us understand what they are and kind of where we are in our own particular orientation towards what's happening in our world and in the future.
That should be very thought-provoking.
It will be. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate with Healthful Living. You can read more about me at healthfulliving.org.
And I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. You can find out more about me and my services at healthfulliving.org, and more about my book and my autism work at nourishinghope.com.
This is Reality Sandwich. We'll be back next Thursday at noon. This is 89.5 KPOO San Francisco. Thanks for listening.